Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we're going to talk with Dr. Jonathan Fisher, family physician at Piedmont Health Services and consultant for the Community Care of North Carolina, about improving end-of-life care for low-income patients, an important topic for sure.
Absolutely. Christy, before we dive right in with research that matters, we should just take a moment just to, this is our first show that actually we've been both together in a month or so. We've actually had a guest host filling in for both you and myself.
Yeah, we want to thank Dr. Bob Gwyther for filling in for us. For sure, he did a great job and is a wonderful part of our team.
Yep. No, it's always important to be able to have people like Bob who can step right in and I think have a lot to contribute. Speaking of contributions, we've got some great research that matters today. We're going to be talking about if anyone breaks a bone, how easy it is, are they going to be able to actually see an orthopedist?
And we'll talk about kids getting asthma meds in the ER, another study about coffee.
Yep. And then finally, do you want to get stronger and better fitness? Well, let's ask, do you have a dog? So let's go right in, though, about this very first research, Christy, about people breaking their arms. And in this particular case, it's about children. And I guess I just actually took it for granted that if my child broke their arm, I'd be able to get in and if I needed to see an orthopedist for this condition, that I'd be able to get in and see one. But that may not be the case.
It may not be the case. This was a study done in California where it's an interesting research method where they called, a researcher called 45 different orthopedic practices around Los Angeles pretending to be the parent of a 10-year-old boy with a broken arm. And they did this about 10 years ago, had one person call pretending to be someone with health insurance, a parent of someone with health insurance, and one who had Medicaid.
Yeah, and what they discovered is there's a huge difference between if you are having private practice insurance, that of course many more practices would agree to see you than if you had Medicaid. And I guess what was surprising is twofold. One, those who even had private practice, privately insured, less than half of the practices gave appointments for those children within a week, indicating that even within these orthopedic specialists, a lot of them weren't practicing pediatrics, a common routine, common issue, but is even worse with the those who were Medicaid.
Yeah, only one practice out of 45 was willing to set up an appointment for a child covered by Medicaid. And then when they compared the study they did 10 years ago with the study now, it just shows that fewer of these practices are willing to see kids. So, I mean, to me, Adam, this highlighted the need for healthcare reform and some changes in our access to care, but also the need for well-trained family doctors and other primary care providers who are willing and able and well-trained to see, broken bones of children.
And maybe this isn't such a problem in some of the large cities, though this was in Los Angeles, but we can imagine in smaller communities and rural communities. You know, Christy, there's a really interesting article that I think was in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple months ago, and we should get the author of it on here, but they looked at this problem because across all types of specialty clinics, because I wondered, well, is it just bad in orthopedics? Maybe it's mm-hmm. bad in neurology or endocrinology or dermatology or psychiatry. And I think they found that this is really a problem across multiple specialty practices.
The difference between taking insured versus Medicaid?
Yeah. And so this problem of Medicaid, people may have insurance, but they can't actually get seen for problems. And so I think we should really talk about this. So maybe we can actually have the author on the show and really talk about this issue, because maybe this is about healthcare reform, as you said, and how do we pay people? And maybe we have to look at reform mechanisms that pay providers who are willing, who get trained with public dollars through Medicare mm-hmm. and Medicaid, maybe get reimbursed higher for seeing those patients.
That's a really good point. Well, look forward to further conversation on that. But now we have another study that relates to children, and this is about kids who get asthma meds after coming to the emergency department.
Well, and this is actually an important study for me because one of my children has asthma, and we have had to go to the emergency room. He was doing just fine, and then was out there playing a sport and had a severe case of asthma, and we had to go to the emergency room and get treated. And this study looks at these type of children, and then do they get prescribed when they leave medicines that actually help them not get asthma. So the types of medicines like inhaled steroids. For instance, my son wasn't on an inhaled steroid before he went to the emergency room.
Well, and traditionally, the emergency room doctor would say you should follow up with your primary care doctor to get on a long-term controller medicine. But then the guidelines changed to say, go ahead, emergency doctors, prescribe those long-term controller medicines themselves because we know they work. And out of 3,000 South Carolina children who were low-income children who had an asthma attack in the ER, the sad thing was that only a minority of them actually either received and filled the medicine within the next month or two.
Yeah, 18% actually filled a prescription for an inhaled steroid. Now, there could be lots of reasons. You know, we don't know for certain that the doctors didn't all write it. It could be reasons why they didn't get it filled. Maybe they couldn't afford it. But it really suggests that the guidelines aren't being fully followed, and mm-hmm. we have to both educate providers, our colleagues, to prescribe
these medicines. I have to ask my husband, does he prescribe this every time?
We'll have to have that conversation. But also encourage our listeners, our patients, our friends to ask for these types of medicines because you say, yeah, I'm getting treated now, but how am I going to prevent this? And in the case of my child, luckily, the people, our providers in the emergency room did say, not only do we want to give you an inhaled steroid to take, we also want you to have a lot more education. They gave us a good follow-up appointment.
That's great. Well, and the take-home message for listeners out there is if you have a child with asthma or if you have asthma yourself, you really should talk with your doctor about a long-term controller medicine.
And right now, get your flu shot and get a pneumococcal vaccination if your child has asthma. That article in the Journal of Pediatrics, we'll post it online.
Okay, the next one is another one about coffee. Now, when I read this, Adam, I thought for sure you would say, we can't talk about coffee again.
Well, no, because this is about lower depression risk in women. And I know that's a group we haven't necessarily talked about. And you know what? I thought that, but then I looked at this study and I said, it's a really good study, Christy, and I liked it. I've only had my 2 cups of coffee today, so I don't know if it'll apply to me, but it's an important study, and I think let's go with it. What would they find?
Okay, what they found was that women who drink 4 cups of coffee a day.
Is that you?
Yes, okay. If you count their cups.
Okay.
My cups are huge. I drink 2 huge ones. Are 20% less likely to become depressed compared with women who rarely drink coffee.
And
big study.
A big study, and this was in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and this is that nurses' health study that we've talked about a lot, and they had over 50,000 women, and they're on average age in their early 60s, and none of them of these women were depressed when they entered the study, so they tried to control for lots of factors like depression or other things that could be related to depression and coffee consumption, like cigarette smoking even.
And, I mean, it was pretty impressive to find that the women who were in the top 1/5 of caffeine consumption, not just coffee, but overall caffeine consumption, had a 20% lower risk of depression than the women in the bottom 1/5 who didn't drink very much coffee or take total caffeine as much.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem that we don't know yet how coffee could be protective against depression, but there might be neurotoxins that are related or certain areas of the brain that link depression and even diseases like Parkinson's disease, some lower amounts with this coffee consumption. So I think we're both impressed. A lot of evidence we presented that this is one non-pharmacologic way of perhaps lowering your risk for depression.
Yeah, it's more of a prevention. It's not like coffee's going to treat your depression. We don't have enough information. But to me, it's going to help me enjoy my morning pleasure that much more.
And you don't look depressed today, Christy. You look very happy.
Thanks, man.
And do you have a dog, by the way?
I don't have a dog.
Well, our next study, though, should suggest not only will you be happier with your coffee consumption, but if you have a dog, you'll be more fit.
I will. Experts say that dog owners walk more, walk faster, and are more likely to enjoy an active lifestyle because of their animal friend.
Yeah, they say up to two-thirds of dog owners kind of walk with their pets each week, which also makes me wonder, like, what about those other third? What are those dogs doing out there? Are they just like, go out, little Fido, and come on back in with you.
Good luck. Come on back.
You know, but, and then we should say this study of over 1,000 adults was undertaken at the behest of a pet food company.
Yes.
But it got us both looking at, because these pet owners are walking more, walking faster, and seem to be more active in their lifestyles.
Well, and according to the poll, about 44% of dog owners age 65 and older, so those in that elderly or older persons category, are walking on a weekly basis because of their dog.
So we're gonna try to get the author of this book here about fitness and dogs on the air, because I do we want to talk about it. It's not like there aren't some side effects. I've had patients break bones while walking their dogs and other things. But, you know, Christy, I think we've had some interesting time to talk about fitness and pet ownership.
We talked about coffee again, this time with lowering depression risk.
If you've got asthma and you're in the emergency room, make sure you get that medicine to prevent asthma before leaving.
And with fewer orthopedic surgeons seeing kids and implications for that. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Jonathan Fisher about improving end-of-life care for low-income patients. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jonathan Fisher, family physician at Piedmont Health Services and a consultant to Community Care of North Carolina, about improving end-of-life care for low-income patients.
Certainly an important topic to both of us. Welcome, Dr. Fisher. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Dr. Fisher, and certainly improving end-of-life care for all people is important to both me and Adam, and certainly it is to you as a family physician. But how did this aspect of care and improving it for low-income patients become something that is so important to you?
Well, it's interesting. When I initially thought of going to medical school a number of years ago, if you had asked me, well, why are you interested in going to medical school, Jonathan? And I would have said, well, because I'm really intrigued and challenged by the idea of helping families navigate through difficult decisions and difficult times when they're faced with serious illness. Mostly that stemmed from some of my own personal experiences. And a family physician had stepped into the life of my family at a very difficult time. And a number of my studies as an undergraduate in religious studies and comparative religion, I had developed a strong interest in concepts of death and suffering and how different cultures approached the end of life.
And so certainly during the medical school training experience and then going into residency, you were surrounded by sick people, many of whom probably were dying.
Yes, both in the hospital and on the outpatient side as well. That was a part of our experience and some of the more challenging aspects of that. And sometimes those deaths were acute and unexpected, such as on a labor and delivery floor or in a child. But other times they were due to chronic illness and should not have been as much of a surprise. And but there was it was a challenge, and really the we were left with the opportunity to facilitate the passage of a patient and help their family come to grips with that and help them to make decisions about how they wanted to be treated as their disease progressed.
Well, I'm sure that those were no less difficult for as a provider in some respects, maybe we can come back to that later in the interview to kind of hear a little bit about how it impacts on you. But, you know, one of the questions is this care at the end of life. We know it is frequently very expensive care, and a lot of times people haven't thought a whole lot about what happens when they get a diagnosis of cancer or fatal disease. And frequently the default is that everything happens to you, that you get every treatment. At what point in time did you decide, I need to get involved in this, because those two things may not be the best for the patient?
I think it really struck me when I was looking for additional activities outside of my clinical time. And I really view myself as an educator, both with patients and with students, with medical students and residents. And when I came to the Office of Community Care of North Carolina.
Deals with Medicaid, predominantly Medicaid patients.
Right. It's an organization that works with the state Medicaid system to develop quality improvement initiatives. So really to look for ways in which providers can improve the quality of care, access to care, and at the same time, look for cost savings as well. So I came to Community Care of North Carolina with an interest in education, as well as an interest in end-of-life care, and it happened to be an area that they were looking to expand into, kind of piggybacking upon some of their efforts with chronic care case management. And together we decided that this was really an area that needed some more investigation. And I set out to find what was the state of end-of-life care in North Carolina. How well are we delivering quality end-of-life care?
What'd you find? Are we doing a good job or not so much?
Well, there's an organization called CAPSI, the Center for the Advancement of Palliative Care, based in New York, and they actually give grades to states to see how well they are doing with the delivery of end-of-life care, in particular palliative care. So,
and you measure pain, or how do you measure suffering?
Well, it's a good question. The metrics for measuring quality of end-of-life care are difficult, but they really have to do with pain and numbers of patients or families that report that had pain in the last months of life, how well families feel supported through the emotional challenges. So, for example, you could look at a specific metric of patients admitted to a nursing home and whether they report pain upon entry and how quickly is that pain remedied during the time that they're there. Or how easily can a person access a palliative care consult? Do the hospitals in your state offer palliative care consults while patients are in hospitals?
And we should define palliative care here, because I think as I'm first hearing this, you know, part of me goes, but wait a second, I've just gotten this bad diagnosis of cancer. I really want to make sure the quality of care is that I get all the available treatments. But we're not really talking about the treatment. It's really when there's no really good treatments that may extend life on a long period of time. Is that to help us understand what we're talking about here in terms of when we say palliative care?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misconception that palliative care is precisely what you were describing, when there's nothing else left to do. Really, palliative care, I like to say, is feel better now medicine. So it's an approach to care that allows a focus on symptom management, so managing painful or troubling symptoms throughout the course of an illness, providing support to family members and caregivers throughout the course of an illness. So it's not necessarily care that's focused on curing or reversing the course of a particular serious illness, but works alongside any curative therapies that might be offered.
And speaking of the difference in understanding what palliative care is and maybe some misconceptions there, you know, I think a lot about trust. I just had a family member in my family who has, you know, cancer, heart disease, had a stroke, all these things. And I mentioned to my mother, you know, is hospice involved? We really need to, you know, be thinking about how we're supporting him. And the immediate reaction is, oh, we're not ready to give up, you know,
right.
That maybe there from a lot of patients out there is some misconception that means that we're not going to care for people. Mm-hmm. And especially as we're talking about low-income patients, you wonder how that trust might play out even.
You're not giving us good care because you think we can't afford it or we can't
pay.
How does that play out? Great question, Christy.
And let me back up for a second, because you raise an interesting point and really a clarification of definitions that needs to happen for most people, a lot of physicians, and certainly the general public. And that is, what is palliative care, and is that different from hospice?
Mm-hmm. And end of life.
An end of life.
Sure.
So a hospice is an approach to care, a philosophy, as well as an insurance benefit, and essentially it is the care that comes into place that is comprehensive, interdisciplinary, so you have nurses, social workers, clergy, as well as physicians, working to support a patient in their last months of life. In order to qualify for hospice, generally a patient is thought to have 6 months or less to live if their disease should progress. Hospice is palliative care, meaning that all of the care that hospice gives can be termed to be palliative. They're not working to cure the disease or reverse the course, but rather to make a patient and their family feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Palliative care can happen much earlier in the course of the disease, arguably from the point of diagnosis with a serious disease.
So you're diagnosed with dementia, per se.
Exactly. So then at that point, a palliative care approach, which could be brought to play by a primary care provider or as well as a palliative care specialist, would then go through with the patient and their family. What are their goals of care? What would they like to see happen as their illness progresses? What are their troubling symptoms at that point? You know, and do they feel confident how to manage those things?
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. When we come back, let's pick up on this theme and really also understand this question of, do those with lower income, is this just, is it ethical, and why is it maybe even necessary? We'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Jonathan Fisher, about improving end-of-life care for low-income patients. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Fisher about improving end-of-life care for low-income patients. And Dr. Fisher, we were talking a little bit before the break about some misconceptions about palliative care and end-of-life care and maybe some trust differences or quality differences between people who have low income versus other people who have lots of resources. Is it really different? Do you have a specific example that would highlight some of the quality problems we have with low-income patients?
Yeah, it's a great question, Christy. And a couple examples come to mind. But the first one that I would offer is if you can imagine a patient in a nursing home and a patient with dementia in a nursing home who, as their disease progresses, they stop eating. And a family feeling concerned that they want to do the best thing for their loved one consents to having a PEG tube or a feeding tube placed in that patient so they can continue to receive some form of nutrition. So that patient would then get transferred to a hospital and for having that procedure done. When you look at the data around, is that PEG tube procedure, is that actually going to improve the quality of life for that patient or extend that patient's life? The data is pretty solid that not only will you end up causing more suffering in that patient, the procedure itself, and then the patient's likely to start pulling on the tube and may end up needing restraints or sedation, that you actually giving that patient that nutrition doesn't extend their life. You're not likely to get any or very little extension of their overall life. So now that's going to be true for any patient, Medicaid or not.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, indigent patients, patients without resources, are less likely to have the opportunity for those discussions with a primary care provider. They're less likely to have a primary care provider. And additionally, there's some inherent suspicion of the medical industry that indigent patients...
So if we say, oh, we don't think your grandfather needs a feeding tube, that they might think we're just saying they're not worth feeding or something.
Why wouldn't you give that to my... Exactly.
Wouldn't you give it to your grandfather?
Right. Are you withholding care from me because I'm poor or, you know, you're not giving me the same quality of care?
What have you been doing in your consultant role with the community care of North Carolina to try to address, which I think has ethical dimensions, it has medical dimensions, it has psychological mm-hmm. dimensions, training of physician dimensions. Well, give us an example of some things you're actually working on.
What we're working on overall is trying to improve access for hospice and palliative care services to patients that might not otherwise encounter those services. So enhancing the palliative care programs in hospitals, training care managers that work with Medicaid patients as they're being discharged from hospitals, or those care managers working with primary care practices, so that care managers can help to empower patients to ask for high quality care. Patients have been, or let me back up and say that it's been shown that indigent patients are not as aware of what hospice can provide and what hospice services exist. So what we hope to do is to fill that education void, and that way patients feel that they're making choices about the care that's in front of them rather than the system making the choices about what is going to be done to them.
And is there an effort to have those conversations happen, you know, once you help folks? I know Community Care of North Carolina helps people get into primary care homes to have a relationship with a doctor. But are you working to make those conversations about patient values and hopes of end-of-life care before they happen?
You really have to think about the continuum of care. So there are multiple places in that continuum where that conversation can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Too often, as you and I know, those conversations now happen at a moment of crisis.
In the emergency room, in the hospital.
Exactly. And oftentimes, the primary care physician or somebody that might know that patient's wishes is not there, or the family is being put on the spot to make a decision at that time. So what we're hoping to do is to alert primary care providers to think about the surprise question. Would you be surprised if this patient died in the next year?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer to that is no, then you need to tell that patient that and embark upon that conversation about what those patients' desires and wishes and goals of care are. What's important to them? You know, is it living as long as they can, or is it being pain-free, or is it being some combination of that?
Well, you know, it seems as if this issue of access to those services is directly related to having a primary care doctor, or the continuity, because if you mm-hmm. know the patient over a long period of time, you're more likely to be able to articulate those elements and have some trust. So how do you approach then, you've talked about kind of the training programs, mm-hmm. but you also have to come in it from the patient level to really have them seek sometimes these kinds of efforts. How are you doing that?
Through our care managers, they meet patients as they're being discharged from the hospital or mm-hmm. at moments of transitions of care. And we've spent a fair amount of time trying to train our care managers in pattern recognition so they know who's a patient that might benefit from this type of conversation.
So you have a patient, let's give an example. You have a patient that's diagnosed with lung cancer, mm-hmm. metastatic lung cancer, very bad prognosis. Those patients typically die, for the most part, within a shorter period of time. This is someone that if it were a Medicaid patient, your care manager would do what?
So that patient would end up in the hospital, for example, or come to the attention of a care manager, and that care manager would sit down with that patient and family and basically ask them how their care was going, how they were feeling about that, who would be their healthcare power of attorney. So putting it more clearly to the patient, if you were unable to speak to you for yourself at some point, is there someone around you that can talk about what your wishes for care are? And in the example you give about lung cancer, there's excellent evidence, a recent study in New England Journal of Medicine, that says patients who have lung cancer, if they are met by a palliative care physician alongside whatever curative therapies are directed to that patient, chemotherapy or otherwise, those patients have less pain, a higher quality of life, and actually has been shown to live longer.
So you actually have just defined this link between palliative medicine and high quality care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those are some of the terms.
Mm-hmm. And then how does the case manager or the social worker involved then bring that primary care doctor back into the equation or into it for the first time?
That's one of the most challenging points in that continuum of care, because oftentimes, you know, a primary care provider such as myself might think we're doing a fine job. We're addressing all that this patient needs. So our care managers work to empower patients to ask their primary care providers for those conversations.
Excellent.
So we let them know you can go to your provider and ask them to talk about what are the therapies that lie in front of you. How is this likely to go? Or tell them that you want to talk about a most form or defining what you would want to have happen for you if things should reach a crisis point.
And the truth is this should be happening for all patients.
Exactly. That was the exact question, Christy. Christy, we're thinking alike, a little scary here.
Good job, Adam.
it should be, and it would be good quality care for people with
every single listener out there.
And I guess those with less, but there's clearly that perhaps is it already happening to more likely with those with higher resources and incomes?
Certainly, advanced care planning discussions would be useful for everybody at all stages of life. For a quality improvement organization such as community care, we're trying to prioritize what our efforts are, and so therefore we go for patients that are having the most problems with serious illness. But studies do show that indigent patients are less likely to have a primary care physician, less likely to go regularly to that primary care provider. So oftentimes they're not hearing about those options. They're not having the opportunity for those discussions, which is why African American indigent patients, for example, utilize hospice less, and their referrals to hospice usually come from a hospital setting rather than in a primary care setting, is because they're not having access to those services or those discussions at an earlier point.
We talked a little bit before about how do you measure whether you're doing a good job. And as you're approaching this with Community Care of North Carolina, what are you hoping to find and measure to show that you really are improving this?
We already found it, maybe. We don't know it.
We use several quality metrics. One is what I call an advanced care planning ratio. So we look to see what percentage of our patients have been asked at least one of these advanced care planning discussion questions, whether it's about a healthcare power of attorney or do they have troubling symptoms, or have they talked about their goals of care with their provider? So has somebody opened the conversation with them, embarked upon that, or give them an invitation to a discussion? We also look at something called, in the literature, it's defined as the death service ratio, which is an awful name.
Sounds terrible.
It's awful, but really what it is, it looks to see what percentage of patients who die have had hospice involved in their care. Mm-hmm. So have they had the opportunity for that high quality, all-inclusive care that is hospice? So for example, in nationwide, that number is about 38%. In North Carolina, that's about 36%. If you look at the Medicaid population, it's about 26%. So that tells you that indigent patients in North Carolina are not getting the benefits of hospice services akin to the rest of the population.
Well, we're glad you're trying to change that.
We're going to need to wrap up, but for our listeners, there will be behind the scenes, we're going to have a continued conversation. We'll be able to have a little bit more with Dr. Fisher, who's been talking with us about improving end-of-life care for low-income patients. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, Dr. Fisher, at both the Piedmont Health Services, which is really one of the leading community health centers in the region, in the state of North Carolina, but also for those with need at Community Care of North Carolina.
Thank you, Dr. Fisher.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns, and we have some very diverse ones today.
Yeah, Christy, we're going to be talking about hoarseness, not the giddy up, but the type in the throat for people who have a cold.
We're going to talk about not eating when you have cancer.
The end-of-life care, someone who's had muscle problems and is wondering about whether or not antibiotics would help them.
And about blood pressure getting out of control over time.
Well, let's listen to our very first house call today, Christy, about someone who is hoarse.
Dear Doctors Goldstein and Page, my voice is hoarse for 2 weeks after a cold, and I'm 30 years old and heard that the singer Adele is having surgery. Should I see someone?
Well, you know, that question is one on a lot of people's minds because of the singer. And I didn't know about this singer. How do you say her name, Christy?
Adele.
Adele, not Adele.
No, Adele.
Adele. You can just tell I'm not spending enough time in the culture realm and too much time in the medical realm. But who got hoarse recently, and a famous singer. And so people are concerned when they have the same symptoms.
Yeah, and I think lots of things can cause you to be hoarse. In the case of Adele, I'm not sure the exact details, but we do know that she at least used to smoke.
Yeah, supposedly quit a few months ago when she first developed some hoarseness. And then I also heard that she had some bleeding into her vocal cords.
Mm-hmm. And having studied voice
in
college.
And you sing very well.
Well, thank you. But having, you know, when we were studying voice and doing a lot of singing before, it's very common in the vocal world for people to get vocal polyps and other problems.
Little growths on their vocal cords.
From overuse. And so I suspect the combination of smoking and using her voice so much has caused her some problems, but hopefully she'll be back soon.
Yeah, and these vocal cords actually do a lot of things. So not only do they help us talk, like Christy and I talking right now, but they're also, you need them to breathing and protection during swallowing. So they form a lot of functions. And that suggests also that other things that could cause problems, like problems with your swallowing or reflux of acid, can cause hoarseness.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of reasons. You mentioned having a cold. A virus is a very, very common reason to become hoarse.
Yeah, and usually that will last 3 weeks or less, and kind of like you don't do anything for the first 2 weeks, including we don't prescribe antibiotics because it's viral or usually goes away.
Yeah. So
What would you recommend here, Christy?
I would say to you, first of all, make sure that you don't smoke. And if you do smoke, now would be a great time to quit.
And if you do smoke, you might have to see someone because this could be something more serious.
Absolutely. And if it's going on more than a few weeks, then definitely go in and get it checked out.
Okay. Well, let's move on and listen to our very next house call.
My mother is dying from cancer and is not eating anymore. What exactly kills people like her in the end, and how long does it take?
This is a tough one. First of all, we are both sorry to hear that your mother is dying. And cancer is just such a difficult thing, and it's a process. And the problem for answering the question is just that everybody is different and situation is different, and it's common that people might not want to eat in the setting of dying from cancer, but it's hard for doctors to know exactly how long that will go on.
Yeah, you know, the kind of cutting down on eating is kind of the cutting down on living and that process of dying taking hold. And, you know, what exactly kills them in the end? Well, when they quit eating and drinking, which could, like you said, Christy, it could last a week or 2 weeks, sometimes even more, even without eating or drinking. The kidneys shut down, and there is what's called renal failure. But if you ask me what caused them to die, I wouldn't say it's renal failure. I would say it's the cancer.
Yeah, I would too. And it's hard. I mean, what happens to most people is that as they don't eat, they just sort of start sleeping more, and you know, hopefully,
and if they're in pain,
being treated for pain,
right? Yeah. And hospice can be involved and give them some medicine, but. Hopefully it's a time of quiet and reflection. And thank you for sharing that question, because I'm sure lots of our listeners have experiences with their own families that are similar.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear our next house call question.
I've had muscle aches for 2 months, and I was told I should take antibiotics by a friend for tics. I also take some medicines for depression and thyroid, but I've been on these for a few years with no problems. What do you all think?
Muscle aches and antibiotics
for tics.
And a friend suggested it. Thank you for the friend.
Yeah.
We all have friends who are suggesting things to us, and I can understand why the friend suggested it. Maybe they had a tic illness and they had muscle aches and they took antibiotics and they got better.
Yeah, and it's hard to know. In this case, you know, most of the tics around North Carolina cause that Rocky Mountains. But if you're going to get sick from a tick, it would be more
less likely that Lyme.
Exactly. The kind that causes the muscle aches.
Yeah. So, and you're also on some medicines that can cause muscle aches, like any medicine can cause it. It's not just depression and thyroid, the common cholesterol medicines, and almost any medicine could cause muscle aches.
It's true. And it can be related to other things like muscle breakdown or fibromyalgia or other pain syndromes.
Yeah. So if it's new and you hadn't had it before, it does make us kind of want to look for something new around you and less likely to think about those medicines. So, Interesting question. Would you give antibiotics here, Christy, if they came to you?
I would not. I mean, I would get a lot more information, and I would investigate thoroughly, but I wouldn't lock in on antibiotics for a tick.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't either. And I guess the question comes up how strongly our listener feels about the fact that they need to try those antibiotics. And
do they have any other symptoms of tick illness?
Right. I mean, if you said, I've been out camping in the woods.
And I got this giant rash on my arm and the whole thing.
And we'll definitely give you some antibiotics. You raise lots of interesting questions. I don't know if our answers are as good as your question, but thank you for sharing it with us. Let's listen to our next one.
I am 55 years old and have had well-controlled high blood pressure for many years. Recently, I went to see my family doctor, and my blood pressure was 176 over 106. Wow, I was really scared. What went wrong?
Good question for us our last question for house calls, because it's an important one, because a lot of people have high blood pressure. And boy, you know, we hear this all the time. You know, well, I'm surprised that it's high today because I've been feeling great.
Well, sometimes it's high and you don't know it either because you haven't checked it at home and it's been running high and you don't feel bad yet. Sometimes you could just be having a really bad day, be upset about something, come in the office, see that scary Dr. Goldstein.
In his white jacket.
And it makes your blood pressure go up.
Even though he's laughing all the time. But what about the patient who sometimes even cuts down on their medicine because their blood pressure was doing real well?
Mm-hmm. And some now people all of think, a sudden, oh, my blood pressure is so, the values are so good that I don't need to take that medicine. But yet the reason it was good was because you were taking the medicine.
Yep. Or even maybe lots of different reasons, because sometimes even the way you take it could affect it. Maybe you're taking it at nighttime when your blood pressure is going to be low, and yet we're measuring it during the daytime when it's going to be higher.
And the final point that comes to my mind is that as you get older, your blood pressure is often harder to control. So if you gained a lot of weight, and then, or if just through time and age, sometimes it requires additional, for most people, it requires more than one medicine to control your blood pressure.
Yeah. So we don't want you to be scared. We'll take on that responsibility for you. But it can be managed. And if it's elevated, and this is a chronic disease like many things, and chronic diseases get better and worse sometimes. So don't be scared. Nothing went wrong necessarily. But explore some of the things that Christy mentioned and I mentioned, and talk about it with your doctor.
Sounds like a plan. So we've talked a little bit about sudden elevations in blood pressure and about muscle aches.
Yep. About some of the process of end of life and what one may expect. And then finally, about the hoarseness from lots of things, but hopefully not from smoking.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and we hope you'll join us next time for your health.
On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.